are ill to this very day. And then
terrorism, chemical attacks, dirty bombs, fallout, biological attack, anthrax, and to top it all off, duct tape and plastic. Alarming words for our time. But how do you protect your family during such a crisis? The video Sheltering in Place, Surviving Acts of Terrorism from Biological, Chemical, and Radioactive Fallout was developed by Wayne LeBaron, a health physicist who has served as a specialist in environmental health, communicable diseases, and has worked as a nuclear specialist for the U.S. government. Anyone can follow the simple instructions. It's presented by a housewife as they walk you step by step through the process of preparing your home as a shelter. If you're not the type who waits till it's too late, then you need the video Sheltering in Place. Get the critical information you need now for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438 and tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And so, Joel, tell us what we're going to be talking about today.
Well, it's been a very discouraging week listening to the evasive testimony of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker before Congress. It's very obvious that the U.S. has no intention of ever getting out of Iraq, and there's more conflict on the horizon. You know, Stan, the excuses are legion. When things are portrayed as succeeding, they say, well, there's still much work to be done, so we have to stay. Then when things are going badly, as recent events show, these events are used to justify continued occupation. So they win either way. You know, plans to draw down troops are being delayed indefinitely. And the performance this week by those in Congress claiming to be critics of the war was even more disturbing. Not once did we see them contest vigorously the evasions and distortions of these two political witnesses. They allowed bland and servile statements to stand without debate. Crocker was not called on the carpet over last September's promises to use measurable benchmarks. Remember that, Stan? All that talk about these benchmarks have to be measurable. We're going to check up on you. There wasn't a single question about the benchmarks and the fact that everyone said, well, we're not going to do this indefinitely. But the benchmarks have failed miserably. They have not kept the U.S. from being sucked into a political and military quagmire. So what good are these benchmarks if no one's checking? And if there are no consequences for failure to meet them? Well, it's clear that all the talk about benchmarks was merely a pacifier to create a wait-and-see attitude among the public. Well, we've waited and we've seen, and the results are worse. But the excuses keep flowing.
Well, I think it's really so tragic because our men are fighting valiantly over there, but they're never going to win this war, and they're not intended to win this war. And until, of course, we cut off the supplies to this small al-Qaeda there, but, of course, then we'd have to do something about Saudi Arabia and Pakistan that funded al-Qaeda, created al-Qaeda, and then, of course, from this we do something to placate the Sunnis. Actually, we were hiring a lot of them, giving them $300 or $400 a month after we destroyed their jobs. We closed down the factory, so they had no place to work. They had to go many times to the insurgents to have money simply to feed their families. And now we're laying them off again, and then we wonder why the tempo of violence is beginning to pick up again.
Well, you know, even the confidential draft agreement between the al-Maliki government and the Bush administration covering the future of U.S. forces in Iraq is an open-ended agreement. You know, there are no limitations on time, troop levels, basing, or political control. You know, as the U.K. Guardian pointed out, the document even says, this authorization is described as temporary, and the agreement says the U.S., quote, does not desire a permanent basis or a permanent military solution. But, you know, that's simply a lie to pacify the opposition. The absence of a time limit or restrictions on the U.S. or other coalition forces, including Britain, you know, is simply means that they intend to stay. And, you know, it's interesting, Justin Raimundo this week lashed out at the latest switch in terminology that Petraeus and Crocker had used. You know, you talked about Al-Qaeda, and now they switch to other enemies. It's like endless enemies and endless war.
Absolutely. Well, of course, anybody who's ever studied Al-Qaeda knows they were originally funded. There weren't very many of them, but they were funded by Saudi Arabia and they were funded by Pakistan, both of whom, I believe, are still funding Al-Qaeda, and I wouldn't be surprised if the CIA wasn't slipping a little money in there as well. We need an enemy. After all, if we don't have an enemy, how can we justify keeping our boys there fighting and bleeding and suffering and dying? We'll be back in just a moment here with Joel Skous. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon, Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. We're talking about, of course, what's occurred this week, and Joel's pointing out that the testimony by Ambassador Crocker and by General Petraeus was the same old jargon we always use to justify keeping our troops in Iraq. And definitely, of course, we say we don't intend to do that, but that's a lie. They do intend to keep our troops there, exactly as they keep our troops in Germany 60 years after the war ended, Japan 60 years after the war ended, Korea, well, 50 years over the war ended, 54 years after the war ended. And, of course, we've read their plans. We've read it on the Project for the New American website, Project for the New American Century, www.newamericancentury.org. Read their article on rebuilding America's defenses, and they want permanent stationed troops in the Middle East. And that's what Iraq was really all about. We're not fighting to win. We're simply fighting so we have a justification to keep our troops there. And so the American people will go along with it, thinking somehow we're fighting for democracy, or, as President Bush says, if we don't fight them on the streets of Baghdad, will we fight them on the streets of New York? Well, go ahead, pick the story up there, Dave. Joel.
Well, you know, they keep switching enemies on us. You know, of course, Al-Qaeda has always been a mythical creation that never really has. I just have to laugh at the media when they say, was suspected ties to Al-Qaeda. Everybody who was captured was suspected ties to Al-Qaeda. Well, where's the evidence of this? You know, how do you trace 2 minutes after this thing occurs, or even 2 days later, how do you trace whether somebody really is part of Al-Qaeda or not, a secret organization? Well, first, you know, the enemy was the so-called dead-enders, the people who had survived the war and that were frustrated in fighting years. Then it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, then it was the Sunnis, and then it was the Shiites, and now it's the special groups. That's their new title for the various Shiite militia that are against them, i.e. al-Sadr. When will it end, asked Justin Raimundo. Aside from the expected drivel and boilerplate rhetoric, the testimony of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker before Congress on Tuesday had few surprises. Yes, we all know about the administration's line. The surge is working. Of course, that's only because they paid off the opposition with millions of dollars in bribe money, as you pointed out. All is well, he says. Oh, sure, more needs to be done, but et cetera, ad nauseum. You know, that's the feeling you get. You just, it's incredible. You get a question from these congressmen, and all of a sudden you say, they're not going to answer this question, and sure enough, they don't. They just give this same old answer and hemming and hawing and pawing around the bush. Raimundo says, which is very much in line with what I've been saying all along. He says, what I sense, however...
Please hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go to the stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Joel is talking about the testimony before Congress, and of course, the congressmen throw them all sorts of softball questions, because as we found out this last week, many of the congressmen and the senators have invested their own money in the war industries so that they'll make a lot of profits as long as the war keeps on going and we send our boys over to seas to fight in another no-win war. So go right ahead with the story there, Joel.
So I'm quoting from Justin Raimundo as he giving his analysis. He says, which agrees very much with my theory, he says, what I sense is a shift away from the alleged threat posed by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which doesn't seem to be much of a factor anymore. Actually, it never was. according to the testimonies of those two principals, and toward identifying the real enemy, the actual target of this administration's latest war plans, Iran. You know, this came out early on in the general's testimonies. He laid the blame on the recent violence in Basra on Tehran's feet. He said the recent flare-up in Basra, southern Iraq, and Baghdad underscored the importance of the ceasefire declared by Muqtada al-Sadr last fall as another factor in the overall reduction in violence. Recently, of course, some militia elements became active again. Though a Sadr stand-down order resolved the situation to a degree, you know, except that the U.S. keeps attacking al-Sadr's forces in spite of their agreement that was brokered not to do so. The flare-up also highlights the destructive role, said Petraeus, of Iran in funding, training, arming, and directing the so-called special groups, and generating renewed concern about Iran in the minds of many Iraqi leaders. You know, this is just ridiculous. Iran isn't any concern to the Iraqi leaders. He's accepted with open arms, with parades and hugs and kisses. When he arrives, this isn't an enemy of the Iraqi leaders.
You're talking about Ahmadinejad now.
I'm sorry, Ahmadinejad,
right,
that's
right,
which is Iran, according to the U.S. here. And the clear purpose, of course, of giving a new title to the enemy called special groups is to implicate Sadr, al-Sadr, as the Iranian agent. The bad news coming out of this hearing is the administration is trying to build up Sadr as the new Saddam Hussein. In this opening statement, Crocker also made the remark that special groups and Sadr were reemerging their forces, another indication that al-Sadr is the new devil. In Iraq, as we potentially, you know, have an endless list of enemies and endless rationales for staying, at the very least 100 years worth, and he's quoting, of course, from John McCain, our next warmongering president, who confirmed this week that he would not rule out using preemptive strikes again, and that clearly is a hint that we're going into Iran sooner or later. Now, as I pointed out before, the U.S. has no desire to see Iraq emerge as a unified an independent entity. After all, you know, that would preclude our continued presence. What the Americas want is a country that is in disarray with no strong leader overseeing the central government, unless it's one of their puppets, and that could be, you know, continued al-Maliki or better yet,
Chalabi. Right.
Ahmed Chalabi. And he's still around. He's still got his organization. He's still being funded by the CIA, so they have him waiting in the balance. Now, one of the problems with the U.S. criticizing Iran's involvement is that Iran also gives military support to the Shiite groups that are allied with the U.S. So how can the U.S. criticize one side of Iranian support and then support, you know, the other side? Raimundo comments on this. He says the all-pervasive influence of the Iranians in Iraqi politics is the problem here. This is the administration's main complaint and a major talking point of the Crocker-Petraeus dog and pony show. Yet this raises an important question. Why, after all, says Raimundo, should the Iranians be funding terrorist attacks on the Iraqi government when Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is a friend of the Baghdad regime? He says the current leader of the Iraqi government spent years in Tehran as the guest of the mullahs who were funding, training, and providing sanctuary to exile groups. And especially both the Badr Brigade and the Dawa Party, the two major components of the ruling coalition. They set up headquarters in Tehran before the liberation and received and continue to receive extending funding and military aid from the Iranians. So how are they different from these so-called special groups? The answer is quite simply that they aren't all that different. Both are Shiite, both are vying for power. But the better answer is that some groups are playing along with the U.S. for the money, and al-Sadr used to be playing along, but is currently not doing so. So now he's on the other side and called a special group. Of course, Petraeus presented no evidence of Iranian direct military involvement, which he claimed, but it continued to be clear that pointing the finger at Iran serves to continue to justify a future attack on that country, which will not be limited to its nuclear facilities. Raimundo finishes with these words. He says, this hearing underscored why public support for the war is steadily eroded, to the point that 60% of the American people want a specific timetable for withdrawal. The one essential question everyone at those hearings, of course, except for John McCain and Joe Lieberman, tried to get Petraeus and Crocker to answer was, where does it all end? Where it ends, of course, he says, is a war with Iran. This is a very good point, because the delays, the spreading this war out, is simply biding time, getting the people to go along until they can get us into a much bigger war. And, of course, it's not just a war in Iran. It doesn't end with that. It ultimately leads, in my theory, to another Third World War, which will cause, by a trigger event such as Iran, or most likely something later on involving North Korea, which is also being preserved, hegemonic and tyrannical state that it is. You know, it's very interesting to oust Saddam Hussein for his war crimes against humanity, and you take a government like North Korea, which is probably five times worse than Saddam Hussein ever was in terms of proliferation and danger to the U.S., including heavy missiles and a nuclear weapons program, and we give them a pass. You know, we aren't even asking for regime change. We let them get away with thumbing their nose at our latest nuclear agreement and simply not abiding by it. Well, it's always been the goal, of course, to keep U.S. troops in the region, and that's why you have four major, huge military bases that we continue to pour billions of dollars in. And I don't think, of course, that when the U.S. attacks Iran that they will attempt to occupy the country, nor could they, even with current troop levels. I think they intend to destroy Iran's infrastructure and control its oil through a secret peace agreement after the shock and awe of destruction has brought Iran to its knees. Now, Professor Juan Cole added some interesting insight into some of the good things that Petraeus did to lessen the violence. He said, Petraeus has done the most responsible job yet seen by an American official in Iraq in trying to end the carnage. He has made bazaars, that means food bazaars and clothing bazaars, no drive zones to stop the car bombings. Very logical. He has surrounded city districts with blast walls to keep insurgents out. But the big question that I say about this so-called good list is, you know, these are obvious things. Why didn't they do that before? The only reason they implemented these kinds of sensible things is they wanted to prove the surge is working. And these things have nothing to do with the surge. The reason the surge is working are three things. One, they stopped the suicide bombers in the bazaars, as he mentioned, and they put barriers around the cities to stop them. Actually, they had waited until the Sunnis had already been purged from these areas, so there was very little reason to be having the Sunnis attack the Shiite areas. But lastly, of course, they were bribing people. So there is no evidence, frankly, that the increased troop levels have really been responsible for what we have seen to any large degree. Now, that isn't to say that our troops aren't doing some good. Clearly, they do handle some bad folks, and they do tend to keep some order in there. And there would be civil war without them. But nevertheless, the things that the surge is being taken credit for are attributable to these outside factors and not the troop levels.
Well, I think that's true. So another reason that the surge worked was because Al Sayler, the fellow with the black turban, actually, of course, it put on a six-month ceasefire. And then, of course, we broke the ceasefire, and then he temporarily went back to war with America. And then, of course, he withdrew again, and now supposedly he's not going to have his troops killing the Americans. But it was the action of this one man that really, I think, was one of the major threats. Things as far as shutting down the violence in the southern part there.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, politically, the surge has been a terrible failure. As Juan Cole said, there's really little sign of political reconciliation, and quite inadvertently, Petraeus's initial disarming of the Sunni Arabs in Baghdad led to a massive ethnic cleansing and the Shiitization of the capital, setting the stage for a future civil war. Al-Maliki started out with a natural unity government. Actually, this isn't quite true. He said he had the Sunnis in the cabinet. That was only because the U.S. pressured them. He had Sadrs in his cabinet, and that's only because al-Sadr wanted time to reorganize and rebuild his organization and bought time by joining with the government to keep from being targeted. There was the Islamic Virtue Party, the Iraqi National List. All of these people are gone now. The government is more fractured and less represented than ever before the surge began.
Well, what if the U.S. military... The advantage of the surge is they could increase the number of troops, and then they could pull some of them out and say, see, we're removing troops, and yet, of course, we still have more troops than we had before the surge.
That's exactly right. You know, U.S. military presence is probably, as Juan Cole says, juvenilizing the Iraqis and prolonging the civil war, meaning that they're keeping them subservient subservient. It's very obvious from this later show of force in Baghdad, when virtually all of the U.S.-backed and Iraqi-backed militias dropped their weapons, retreated, fled from the battlefield, leaving their armored cars and their machine guns and all of their weapons to be captured by the militia. I mean, this is even worse than we thought in terms of the so-called preparedness. And these are the militias who, you know, are really stronger than the Iraqi army themselves.
And, of course, we had provided the weapons and the armored cars to the Iraqi army, and they, for all intents and purposes, turned them over, of course, to the revolutionaries. So what we've done is really increase the armament of our enemies. Why would you do something that stupid and intentionally? Unless, of course, you wanted in justification simply to remain in Iraq indefinitely. And our men are sent over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but they're never allowed to win the war. I mean, we've never had enough troops there. They knew that from the very beginning. They just don't want the American people to understand what's really going on. You go right ahead, Joel.
Well, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about the pathetic show of opposition in Congress. Winslow Wheeler of Counterpunch said it was the best and worst of congressional theater. We saw speeches parading as questions. For example, Senator Kennedy had lots of competition in this, but he was the leader of this pack. He read off a long list of pre-prepared statements about his stalwart opposition to the war and prefaced the thing he was pretending was a question with, "Americans want to know." Now, that's a dead giveaway that there's no real question to follow. The staff, of course, prepared reams of questions to be read off again and again, and no matter what the answer, they just keep reading the questions. They don't respond. They don't drill Petraeus when he evades the answers. This is just a show, Dr. Stan. You know, Senator Daniel Akaka of Hawaii read off several questions, barely waiting for the answer before he read off the next one. At one point, he got an amazing answer about whether the troops only get 6 months of quality time with their families. Petraeus said that, well, the Army could best answer that. Well, who is he? But if he's not the Army's top general in Iraq, and he's asking them to ask the Army about that? Akaka moved on to another question. Petraeus, finding he was quite successful with that, the Army used it again, and he wasn't called on the carpet. You know, any decent debater would have said, well, what do you mean, ask the Army? You are a top general in the Army. You tell me. You can't tell me that you don't know that they're not getting any quality time at home. You hear the complaints of your troops. Then there were platitudes pretending to be questions. Senator Sessions, Republican of Alabama, is typical of this. He skillfully coupled several platitudes like extraordinary sacrifice. You know, all the Republicans pound themselves on the back about supporting the troops. They talk about extraordinary sacrifice, defining moment, magnificent American military, all of these, you know, rah-rah propaganda stunts to ask Petraeus about the prospects for success. And, of course, Petraeus, you know, to his credit, just gave him what he wanted to hear, nothing that really... Republicans basically had softball questions at all. Then there was the issue of failure to launch oversight. You know, Senator Clinton gave what she must have thought was the obligatory speech to demonstrate her vast experience in national security, of course, stating her support for the troops. And then, surprisingly, she asked a very real question, exercising, you know, oversight, basically. That's what these hearings were really for. You know, she first started off reading some staff-prepared questions on conditions that would permit withdrawal. She didn't have any on her own. Then she asked a question which came, what appeared to be from herself. She noted that she heard Petraeus intimate early in a hearing that the U.S. might have its own plans for military operations in Basra before al-Maliki's fiasco was launched. And, you know, so she asked, what were your plans? Well, Petraeus gave a very vague non-answer, but it seemed to confirm what Clinton was saying, that he did have plans for going into Basra before the Iraqis. You know, and much of this is disinformation. You know, they're claiming that the Iraqis went in without coordinating with the U.S., and I don't believe that for a minute. That's more of an excuse to blame the fiasco on the Iraqis, saying we didn't have enough training or preparation for that. Listen, this thing had an American code name. And it wasn't something that you know, Iraqis don't go looking through the dictionary looking for an American code name for an operation. This was clearly something that was coordinated with the Americans. But then Senator Clinton failed to follow up and nail down the first information that she threaded, you know, that she was going to reveal.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel is simply pointing out the absurdity of the hearings, how most of the senators were simply posturing and trying to get their picture, you know, on television. But Senator Clinton, Hillary, had actually asked at least one very, very good question about what General Petraeus' plan was if he hadn't had a plan to go into Basra before the Maliki sent the Iraqi troops in, who got in there and then threw down their weapons and abandoned their armored cars and fled in terror because they didn't want to fight their fellow Iraqis, their fellow countrymen. Most of them are Shias, and both in Basra and, of course, in the military. And of course, they all opposed America's occupation of their country, so they were going to fight and die. So America continued to occupy their country. They simply pulled out. But Hillary asked General Petraeus, you know, what his plan was, and then, of course, she never pursued to find out what it really was. You pick the story up there.
Well, he gave a very vague answer that was, in fact, confirming that he did have a plan, but he didn't say it. So the natural follow-up would have, well, tell us what your plan was, General. I mean, you couldn't have evaded that if you could have refused to answer, but you couldn't have evaded the question if she had no follow-up.
Don't you think
she almost seemed relieved that her time was up. She didn't even ask permission to have one simple follow-up question. She didn't stick around for a second round of questions, nor did she get any of her colleagues who followed her to follow up on this issue. This was clearly no intention to drill these people and catch them in the lies and evasions that they were permitted.
But don't you think it's really all showbiz? It's for the American people. It's smoke and mirrors. It's to give the people the idea that something is really being done, while, of course, the senators and the congressmen, continue making their profits in the defense industry. They have no desire to end this war. They have no intention of ending the war. They just have to make the American people feel that Congress has something to do with what's going on.
That's precisely right. Winslow Wheeler had some very interesting comments about other types of non-questions. He said then there was Representative Collins of Maine reading off questions designed to position herself safely both as an opponent and a supporter of the war. Remember, Senator Inhofe, a Republican of Oklahoma, making sure that everyone knew he had been to an Iraq veteran's funeral. Then there was Senator Warner giving Petraeus a second shot at the question he had flubbed when he first testified to Congress. Then there was Lieberman, of course, aping reasonableness by trying to get everyone to agree on the facts, his facts, of course. I mean, this is congressional theatrics to a T. Wheeler then had an insightful study of Senator McCain's performance. He said, posing as president-to-be, Senator McCain's people did a better job preparing him for this non-hearing than did Clinton's. McCain's questions, all designed to elicit responses about how right he was about the war in Iraq, were asked in a studied monotone with an air of seeming legitimate inquiry. There was none of the unusual harsh lecturing tone directed at either witness or other senators that is typical of McCain during these types of hearings. Clearly, he knew he was on stage to show his presidentiality. And he did as well as John McCain will ever do in that dimension. He surely thought, scored big points with the cooperative witness, agreeing with every nuance of McCain's grasp for omniscience about the catastrophe he helped to stage and now wants to extend. So, I mean, this was just a show in patting each other on the back and agreeing that just an incredible, theatrics that were played. He ends with this comment. He says, through all this palaver, and I can't say questioning because no real questions were asked, there were no answers that advanced our knowledge of what is going on in Iraq. General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker were never in danger of facing anyone who informed him or herself well enough to know when they were being fed baloney. So it was a really bad show. He continues, he says, and if they did, no one had enough spine to correct the general and the ambassador's vague, uninformative answers. After all, the questioners were clearly not after information. They were after political advancement or protection. If they were after information, they are grossly incompetent. Well, sadly, in my opinion, most of these congressmen are not grossly incompetent, but they are simply co-conspirators in this globalist warmongering agenda. But they have to pretend to be somewhat concerned and against the war.
And, of course, I think people have to understand what the real agenda is. They really want a world government. And, of course, we have to go from war to war to war. We have to keep this war going for a while until we can expand it into Iran and then a war with the Muslim world and perhaps, as Joel suggests, with the communist world as well. And if we do, of course, certainly there'll be a nuclear exchange. There'll be terrible damage done to America. But how do you get the Americans to give up their freedom, to give up their sovereignty, to give up their constitution, unless we go through another horrible world war? And then at that point, the American people will forego the concepts of freedom and willingly accept the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Joel, did you sit down there and listen to that full 4 hours of testimony?
I must admit I did not. I did watch several portions, and it just was so nauseating I had to turn it off.
I don't have time to watch it at all, so I depend upon you to keep me abreast of what's going on. But
I did read the transcript. So.
Right. Well, that's even better. Go right ahead.
Yes. Well, I'll move on to another subject. Evidence keeps coming out through whistleblowers that of how extensive our warrantless spying is on American people. Tom Burkhardt of Global Research said this week that last month I wrote that evidence of the FBI's massive wiretapping operation on Americans had been uncovered and that a new FISA whistleblower had stepped forward with information about a major wireless provider apparently granting the state unrestricted access to all of their customers' voice communications and electronic data via a so-called Quantico circuit. Now, Quantico is where headquarters of the Marine Corps is, and FBI has training facilities at Quantico Marine Corps base, which I've been stationed at before. And apparently they're using the Quantico base to set up an eavesdropping center there. And according to whistleblower Babak Pazdar, he's a telecom carrier, which has now been revealed as Verizon Wireless, that he worked for as a security consultant, maintained a high-speed digital line that allowed the Bureau and other security agencies complete access to Verizon Wireless network, including billing records and customer data, all of that transmitted wireless. Now, Verizon, of course, denied the report. They know that unless they get telecom immunity from the government, they are on the line for millions in damages. And could be a major class action suit on that. They denied, of course, that the FBI has open access to its network. They denied, of course, that it's belied by documents obtained by the Electronic Frontier Foundation describing the Bureau's digital collection system. When these allegations first surfaced, they were, of course, stonewalled by the media. Nevertheless, reports continued, and we now have learned that electronic connections between major telecom firms and FBI centers scattered across the country have real-time access to about who is speaking, the time, the duration of each call, and they can also get access to what was said.
But, of course, they don't necessarily have to be terrorists. That's the thing. And, of course, if they were terrorists, they could get warrants. If they want to listen to our conversations, why they're not going to. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before we go on, Joel, would you like to get your number out or the means by which people could contact you, get a copy of the World Affairs Brief, and perhaps even subscribe to it?
Well, the best way to review the World Affairs Brief is to go to my website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. And on the front page is a synopsis of the current World Affairs Brief. This is my news analysis that I give every week about the major stories, such as we're doing today. And people can get a sample copy of the World Affairs Brief by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. That's editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. And relative to the globalist agenda, there's a major piece on my website called Strategic Threats on the right-hand side that gives about a 25-page review of my general theory on what our globalist government is doing in terms of denigrating our liberties and covering for the war preparations of Russia and China and warmongering throughout the world, setting us up as the bully of the world, and what this is all going to come into being relative to World War III. So it's a very interesting piece. I would encourage your listeners to go to World Affairs Brief. They also get free access to all of the major stories that are posted by my research staff today as they sift through and post the best ones for you to read.
And it's a wonderful source of information, information you're not going to get unless you want to spend hours every day up on the web going to all the major websites. So, Sydney, I go to World Affairs Brief every single day I'm in town, and I always feel that I'm a little cheated if I'm out of town and don't get an opportunity to read the synopsis of the stories, and then, of course, to be able to pull them down very, very readily and keep them if they're important. So, and most of them are important, but there's certain ones that, of course, be more important to me. Joel, go ahead and pick up this story. You were talking.
Well, my summary statement concerning FBI spying, and this is the first confirmation we've had of cell phone direct connections with the government. And remember, as I pointed out, for so many years, telecoms have been spying for the government ever since World War II. They've had dedicated offices in all of the switching rooms at all of the major offices of AT&T, Ma Bell, and now with the cell telephone companies as well. And you'll notice that, that there's, once these things get spread through the nose, it takes a whistleblower to do that. We realize these people have been doing this for years for the government.
I think people can go up on the Internet, look up Echelon, E-S-C-H-E-L-O-N. That's E-C-H-E-L-O-N. I believe that's the way of spelling it, Echelon.
Yes.
And you'll find out that this has been going on since the end of the Second World War. It's just more sophisticated now, but they've been listening to all conversations and then by computer and then, of course, having humans go over them. They do this not only here, but they do it throughout the world. We can't let the American people know that the people working behind the scenes don't believe in the law, they don't believe in the Constitution, they don't believe in any of the things they talk about. They've been spying on the American people and the people of the rest of the world for 50 years or more.
You know, the American people are quite naive about this. They think, according to the television and movie scenarios, that when they get some information, some leak for about a terrorist doing something, they say, oh, let's go to a judge and we'll get a warrant to tap his phones, and that's how these warrantless eavesdropping occur. And that's not true at all. Essentially, they surveil everything electronically, email, cell phones, microwave transmitter towers, underground cables, satellite communications. They listen to it all. And they have computers that diagnose and filter according to certain keywords. And of course, they're recording everything for a certain amount of time while they get a chance to decide whether they want to analyze it. So, in other words, they're eavesdropping on everything. They only go to a judge once they've actually got the real conversations and they want a warrant and have to take it to court. They don't get thrown out of court for having done something illegal. That's the only time they take the warrant to the feast of court, is after they've already eavesdropped on everyone's conversation. So there's no way to tell what the government really is collecting. We assume they're listening to all and collecting only limited by their storage capacity for electronic media. And perhaps the only safety of our privacy in the United States left is that all phone media takes a human being to do the final analysis, and that's where the major roadblock is. They don't have enough human beings to do all the analysis, but they are listening to everything. So everyone should assume that all conversations are being listened to.
I think that's so hard, Joel, for most people to think, why would they do that? Well, the reason they do that is because they want a dictatorship, and they want to be sure there's no opposition, and they have a goal, they have an objective, and they're using the military and financial power of the United States to bring about this world government. And the last thing they want is any opposition or any revolutionary group to form that might be able to get public support and overthrow their effort. There's a small group of very wealthy people who control both political parties and make mockery of this concept of democracy. And you want to know who they are? You read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and it's pretty well laid out there. But go right ahead, Joel.
Well, that's absolutely true, Dr. Stan. The target are dissidents. The target are those they have to limit. Every dictatorial government, every communist government, every government, Nazi Germany, targeted the opposition. Anyone that can get very, very ruthless once they get enough power. But they will haul, you know, people in if they can't really prove that they're you know, pro-government. So it gets very, very bad in the end. But this is the beginning, to have the kind of surveillance that allows them to justify incarceration. And that's why, as I pointed out in previous briefs, there are many concentration camps being built and taken off the record once they're built, so that they cannot be discovered. And just recently, there were five prison camps that were taken off the federal list of Bureau of Prisons, including the one that's visible from the freeway in Las Vegas, Nevada. They were taken off the register. They're still there. They're in mothballs. They're ready to be filled up. And, of course, if anyone asks them about them, they say that they are there to take care of illegal aliens. But we know this government has no intention of rounding up illegal aliens. They've said as much that it's impossible to do so. So we know they're holding this excess prison capacity for dissidents someday, and it's going to be a sad day, because when it starts, it's going to move very, very rapidly, and there will be very, very little warning. Well, moving on to the next subject, the Olympic boycott is essentially being derailed even as it's growing. The calls for a boycott are growing. The issue, of course, is over Tibet, and you know, Chinese troops have moved in and suppressed dissidents there, and they've even shot people. They've destroyed protesters. There have been at least 20 people killed now by Chinese soldiers. And so if there's ever a country that has deserved to be sanctioned over its horrible human rights record, it is China, and not just for Tibet. I mean, what goes on in the Lao Gai, which is the gulag version in China, tremendous prison camps for dissidents, and with horrible conditions, many, many deaths, probably over a million people by human rights estimates in China. China should never have been awarded the Games in the first place for 2008. But, of course, we know that the International Olympic Committee is very much a globalist organization that is built to use these things as propaganda. I mean, 20 years ago, I remember them favoring any time the Soviets had something. They would not reveal that the Soviets were cheating and did not have real amateur status. And now that they're not giving preference to the Soviets anymore, still, we find that they give preference to countries like China, trying to promote, as international organizations always have, the leftist, globalist, or communist agenda. I mean, can you imagine the uproar if apartheid South Africa had been awarded the Games in the 1980s? Globalist-oriented governments are showing signs that they're willing to make, you know, token criticisms of Beijing, but none are willing to push for an actual boycott of the Games. For example, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper said his government wasn't even going to discuss boycotting the opening ceremonies over human rights concerns, nor will it boycott the Games themselves. You know, boycotting the opening ceremony is a way in which other leaders like Britain's Gordon Brown are considering to show some support while refusing to actually boycott the Games. In other words, it's a little token boycott to say, well, we won't show up at the opening ceremonies. President Bush is expressing concern, you know, for the plight of the Tibetans who are protesting, but quietly at the same time reassures China that the U.S. will never support Tibetan independence nor boycott of China.
Well, you know, Joel, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because we see these spontaneous demonstrations all over the world on the same day. You know, in Paris and London and San Francisco. I mean, and of course, obviously somebody's coordinating this. Who do you think is really coordinating it? Who's putting up the money? Or is it one of these ideas where you always want a controlled opposition that'll never get out of line?
No, I think that there's legitimate opposition to the Games. I think there's legitimate protests. Protests are always organized, to be sure, and but there are most of them are leftist, anti-globalist organizations that see the protection of China and the shipping of jobs overseas as a real problem. You know, the American right wing never tends to protest. Seems to be beneath them. You can only count on the left. There are no such things as spontaneous protests. You're correct. But the only things that have been engineered by governments are the pro-Chinese supporters that get out there in the thousands, such as we saw in San Francisco. But, you know, city governments are in collusion with national governments as they attempt to thwart the effect of these protesters who are intent on interrupting the political propaganda surrounding the passing of the Olympic torch around the world. San Francisco diverted the route of the torch run without informing thousands of spectators standing for hours trying to get a glimpse. China turned out thousands of Chinese residents in San Francisco to counter the overwhelming number of anti-Chinese protesters. And then city police used the excuse of potential conflict to essentially keep the anti-Chinese protesters away from the torch. And, of course, city politicians in San Francisco were clearly marching to accommodate to the orders of accommodating Chinese dictates. For example, we saw on the front page of a major newspaper in San Francisco, the...
Chronicle?
Yeah, the Olympic torch sandwiched between Chinese officials and some of the blue men in blue. These are Secret Service people that the U.S. has allowed into the country to enforce, you know, this protection on this propaganda passing of the torch. You know, why in America do we need these monsters to enforce China's gruesome agenda on the world, to let their goons in there to protect this torch, which is a propaganda symbol, is really playing along with the Chinese.
But then why are we doing everything we can to build up China's military and financial power and manufacturing power? It is the American government that's encouraged our factories to move over there. It's the American government that's guaranteed the safety of the investments. It's the American government that's loaned a great deal of the money. If it's not the American government, it's our major banks, which work hand in glove with the government, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase, investing countless billions of dollars in China in this ruthless totalitarian dictatorship. And there's never an outcry from the American people, and I wonder why.
Well, you know, the Americans have been rather subverted. You know, we've had the benefit of cheaper prices for years because of Made in China, and so people are afraid of losing that. They're afraid of losing the job if we don't bail out Bear Stearns and other people. Of course, what we are losing is the value of our dollar and coming up with massive inflation.
And what we're losing is our moral position, our high position, our altruistic position of really believing that the Chinese people should have the right to be free.
That's right. But, you know, there's an awful lot of people who are believing the propaganda that trading with China will lead to freedom there. And this has never been true. You know, they're somewhat succumbed to the propaganda about the fall of the Soviet Union, that it was essentially trade and an economic collapse that made them go down, but it isn't true at all. It is true that the economy was very, very rock bottom and very basic because of the communist demand-driven system with too much control and no incentive, but no nation has ever collapsed economically. This was a carefully crafted deception in order to get Western aid to beef up its economy, which it's doing. And this is why the Chinese are playing along with the pretenses of capitalism, so as to finance their huge military budget, which they're doing. You know, it's even worse during other former Republican administrations. I remember when I had a contact at used aircraft in California that was telling me that they were having Chinese military people allowed into their top secret facilities, looking over their shoulder to plans for aircraft and missiles and various other things that U.S. were involved in. And the workers, through their unions, began to protest about all these Chinese military people having to run the plant. And so what did U.S. aircraft do? They ended up shutting down the whole company on Saturdays, locking the employees out and letting the Chinese general come in and look at anything they wanted during Saturdays. And this was just an open and shut case of treason on the part of the first Bush administration in allowing Chinese to have access to our top military secrets.
But then it continued under the Clinton administration, then it continues under the current Bush administration.
Yes, through the Commerce Department. They have an actual secret organization which helps facilitate technology transfers to China through the Commerce Department. And all the while that they have another division in the Commerce Department that's supposed to stop these technological transfers to. You know, it's like the black and white side of the CIA or the FBI or the DEA. We have a black and white side of commerce as well.
And we had a congressman on one time from Utah, as a matter of fact, and he was saying that the administration had guaranteed the factories were moving to China that if their companies were nationalized, they would not only get back the money they'd invested, but two or perhaps even three times the amount they'd invested, backed up by the American government. Needless to say,
so the Chinese wouldn't pay, we would pay. Yeah.
Right, of course, and needless to say, that congressman was only in Congress one session, and the Republicans, he was a Republican, but the Republicans got rid of him. The last thing they want is people going on to talk radio and telling the truth about how we are building up the best enemy money could buy.
That's right. And, you know, part of the payoff system that's involved in keeping these congressmen in line is the kind of thing that's been revealed now that the Hillary Clinton's tax return has been revealed. You know, you take a close look at the rapid rise of Hillary Clinton's fortune, and it's only the tip of the iceberg, of course. It doesn't take into consideration the millions the Clintons have stashed away in secret Swiss bank accounts. But as Times Online said, the meteoric rise of the Clintons to the rank of one of America's wealthiest families has presented a challenge to Hillary Clinton's presidential pretensions as the champion of the poor. The Clintons left the White House burdened with debt, you know, so they claim, but have earned $109 million in the past 8 years, putting them among the 14,000 richest families in the country.
Well, don't you think really it's sort of a payment for services rendered to the establishment? That's really what it's all about. And you find that every president, when he leaves the presidency, gets well paid off. Certainly Alan Greenspan was given $8 million for his book, The Age of Turbulence. The Pope only got $8 million for his book. You know, that was with 1.25 million Catholics in the world. Our guest has been Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief. Get his information. It's excellent. Hang on, Joel. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
No, I guess we got one more minute to go. We'll go right ahead.
Well, you know, the big story here is his relationship with Ron Burkle, the financial investment magnate. Bill Clinton has his own rooms in Burkle's mansion in Los Angeles. He gets some $20 million a year from this company for virtually nothing, doing nothing. And it's just amazing how the establishment. Now, what is the quid pro quo? Obviously, they're not getting anything out of Bill Clinton, but Yucaipa Capital, which is Burkle's company, has immunity like Enron had from its shady financial deals. That's one of the things that they pay this money. This is hush money. It's not that Bill Clinton himself personally runs that protection racket. But this is, as I say, payoffs for people who do the bidding of the establishment once they're deep on the inside. And of course, Bill Clinton has many secrets to tell. So this really is payoff time for everyone involved to make sure that he gets his $100,000 a crack for speech. I mean, no company in their right mind can justify that kind of a payment from Bill Clinton to come and simply shake hands and glad hand around people. But that's the way it works with Enron and including the big five accounting firms who are used to look the other way at CIA front companies and to protect companies like Enron and Yucaipa Capital.
Well, we're in a tragic situation. I mean, I hope the American people really will stop and question, do we really think that, of course, Bill Clinton's speeches are worth $100,000 each? To raise $109,000 since, what is that, over a period of
million,
$709 million over a period of seven or 8 years is, well, obviously, this is a payoff. And the American people must understand this is standard operating procedures. The same thing happens to our congressmen who do the right thing. The same thing happens to our senators that do the right thing. And whenever you concentrate power in government, why, you can be sure there's going to be corruption. We're just about out of time. Do you have one parting thought before we let you go?
No, it has been a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan. Enjoy it very much, and certainly want to recommend people that they go to your website and look at your extensive library that you have, especially your videotapes, which are so educational.
Well, thank you so very much, and we'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. Bye-bye. All right. Final guest has been Joel Skelton, certainly one of our favorite guests, and I hope yours as well. And we'll be back here in just a moment with the wrap-up for today's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you did enjoy our program with Joel Skousen. I always enjoy him, and I believe he's absolutely right. I mean, that there is a plan to have a much larger war, but they can't tell the American people that any more than they can tell the American people the First World War was contrived, and we had no business going into that. The Second World War was contrived, and if you doubt the background, that of course the American corporations were funding and helping and building the war equipment for Adolf Hitler both before and during the war, you need to get my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, and the syllabus that goes with that, and the books that go with that, books like Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and Charles Ingham's book, Trading with the Enemy, and There's Nothing New Under the Sun. If you don't understand that we financed Adolf Hitler all during the Second World War, you can't understand that we're financing communist China today. And, of course, we've been funding communist Russia. First of all, let me suggest you get our pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance. It's a short little pamphlet, but tremendous information in it. Solzhenitsyn's speech, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's speech, Professor Sutton's speech that cost him his career in academia because after he gave his speech back in 1972 to the Republican to the presidential, it was the Platform Committee of the Presidential Convention back in 72. When Professor Sutton got back to the Hoover Institute, his name had been removed from the door of his office, his telephone had been disconnected, the furniture had been moved out, and of course, he could never again get a job working for an academic institution. They don't want people who are going to tell the truth, because of course they can't let the American people know. We've created the best enemy money could buy, and that is in communism and in Nazism, and now, of course, in the Islamic terrorist movement, which was created by the United States Central Intelligence Agency that funded the whole Islamic terrorist movement and the indoctrination of young people both in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is covered in some pamphlets we have called Foreknowledge 911. You can, of course, get the documentation for what I'm saying, and you can go to the sources. And if you want to see, I'd like to get a copy of the clipping from the Washington Post about the ABCs of jihad going into the fact that the American USAID organization for Agency for International Development put out some $51 million for Islamic textbooks to indoctrinate the Islamic youth in this radical form of Islam, the best enemy money could buy. Well, let me suggest several things you need to get. You need to get our pamphlets on the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. There's just one pamphlet. It's only $3.95 plus shipping, but it's very important. Then, of course, you need to get the book, The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, or my DVD, my interview with Professor Sutton before he died. The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. You, of course, need to get the material we have on concentration camps. First of all, the planned police state talk and the syllabus that goes with that, and I recommend them both. And there you'll actually see the footage from the hearings at the Iran-Contra, where Congressman Jack Brooks is trying to bring out the fact in 1988 there's a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and the right of habeas corpus and round up Americans and put them into concentration camps. The video is called The Planned Police State. You, of course, need to get my material. It's called The America Behind Barbed Wire. It's put out by our friend Dave Wagner, and you'll see the pictures of the camps. There really are camps out there, ladies and gentlemen. We have a concentration camp 4-tape special. You can get the concentration camps special, actually. It's, of course, a number of DVDs and four tape sets and actually government documents about the use of civilian internees at military camps. That's the concentration camp special. Or if you want to get the items separately, you can, but they're much more expensive. Let me suggest the amazing clips, where, of course, you can actually see that footage with Congressman Jack Brooks. We're trying to bring out the fact that there's a plan for putting people into camps, and then Senator Inouye interrupting him, and then you'll see the clip from Congressman Gonzalez saying, yes, there really is a plan, but, of course, they don't want the American people to know, which, of course, is quite true. So remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.